Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, November 23rd. I'm Ray Graff. We'll be discussing birds today on the show. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about birds the last 36 hours or so, but before we stare at one on our dinner table, let's talk about birds with experienced birder Rich Guthrie, who will join us to provide his usual sterling insight on everything from housing to feeding. Also joining us today is Kelly Martin, educator and wildlife rehabilitator. The number to call if you want to talk birds today is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also, email the program, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. Rich Guthrie, Kelly Martin, we talk birds with you coming up after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm your host, Ray Graff. We discuss birds once a month or so, and we always do that with Rich Guthrie. Now, tomorrow's Turkey Day, and we're going to answer questions about less tasty, quite frankly, faster winged creatures today. Birds that we would bird and we would take pictures of and look around at. Rich Guthrie is our resident expert on all things bird. And joining Rich today and me is Kelly Martin, who is an educator and wildlife rehabilitator. The number to call if you have a bird question, not related to turkeys, unless they're wild turkeys, is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Or you can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that phone number is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie, welcome back.
Hey, good to be here.
Well, it's the day before Thanksgiving. I know you have cranberry sauce to make, so I appreciate you carving some time out of your day for this program.
Hey, when it comes to taking time out from making cranberry sauce, well, wait a minute. I like making cranberry sauce.
Cranberry sauce is fun, right?
Yes, you listen to the little beat, the berries pop as you boil them and
really
stir them up.
I've never done that. Now it's suddenly Food Friday.
Well, I want to tell you, sometimes it's a lot easier to make the cranberry sauce than to open the can that you get at the store.
Yeah, now do you go for the gelatinous cranberry sauce or
the whole berry.
The whole berry.
Yeah, the squish berry in there, the lumpy stuff. I like that.
You're such a traditionalist.
Well.
Just like the Puritans.
You know, it's all part of being easier.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, also joining us today is probably someone even more interesting than Rich, is Kelly Martin, who's an educator and wildlife rehabilitator. And you've been on these airwaves a long time ago with Sue. You had a book, right?
I didn't. I joined someone who had written a book about humane control of nuisance wildlife, and I kind of provided the sometimes opposing view on how to handle those things.
Oh, good. So you're a contrarian. That's what we need on this program.
Often.
Excellent. So what do you do, Kelly?
I am an educator using live wildlife in education programs. I work part-time at the Hike Preserve in Rensselaerville, and I'm also a state and federally licensed wildlife rehabilitator.
That must be exciting work.
It is.
And so what have you rehabilitated lately?
I actually just released a Cooper's Hawk this morning.
Ah, wonderful.
That had a fractured leg and did very well. And much to the chagrin of my chickadees in my yard, I just let it go at my house.
Ah, well, that could be dangerous, right?
Yes, it could. And then my exciting thing this year, I don't just rehabilitate birds. I also do mammals and reptiles, but I had a couple of bobcat kittens this year, which was exciting for me.
Mm.
I've been doing this for over 30 years, and it's the first bobcat I have ever had.
Well, that's very interesting.
So, it was.
Now, when a bird breaks a leg, I'm assuming a cast is not involved.
Not usually, no.
No?
Sometimes you can mend with just a wrap. Sometimes you need surgery. This one did okay with just cage rest, and we didn't have to do too much intervention.
Well, that's exciting work. I hope you're ready to take some calls today.
I am.
Rich is the acknowledged expert, so we will defer to Rich on all questions. And then if he can't
unless
answer
I don't know the answer, then I'm going to
he'll throw it over to
right,
Kelly.
Yes,
right.
Kelly,
our number is 800-348-2551, and we will start the program with Howard in Steventown. Hello, Howard.
Hello there.
You're on.
Let's talk bluebirds.
Okay.
I moved a little over a year ago to an open piece of land in Steventown, and I see more bluebirds here than I've probably seen my entire life before then. Huge numbers. In the fall, I literally get flocks of bluebirds coming here. And up until our recent snow dump, I still had plenty of them around, and they actually looked like they were nesting in the birdhouses I have up. So what do these guys eat? What do they do, you know, once winter comes around?
Well, bluebirds tend to stick around all year anyway, and the numbers have increased because people have been putting out bluebird nest boxes, giving them an ample opportunity to raise the next generation. So it's been working very, very well, and I applaud people who do that. And the thing, during the winter, bluebirds will have a varied diet, but they will mainly consist of berries. They'll look for the wild grapes or the sumac berries or poison ivy or bittersweet, buckthorn, those berries that are out there. And that's their main fare through the winter. If it's a mild day and there's some moths flying around or the like, they'll help themselves to what they can catch. But mainly it's all about berries.
Mm-hmm.
And they will use the nest boxes as a roost overnight. So it's... on many occasions, not all the time, and they will use them communally. So instead of just one pair occupying a nest box, you might have four, five, or six separate bluebirds using the same box.
Hmm.
Oh, this really explains a number of things, actually.
Good.
That's what we're here
for.
Well,
that's great. I really appreciate the information. I just, I thought bluebirds were mainly insect eaters and... I do have some berry bushes around here, so that actually explains.
There you go.
There you go.
Well, Howard, have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Birds today on the program with Rich Guthrie and Kelly Martin and Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Ray and Rick and Kelly, thank you very much for being on the air. I appreciate it. The bluebird thing was interesting because I have bluebirds and bluebird boxes. But the reason why I called is because a good friend of mine that lives down the road had a bat that was orange.
What?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Orange bats?
Nope.
Go
ahead.
He was wondering what type of bat it was that was orange.
Well... chances are what we call a red bat. And a red bat, not really red, not really orange, but somewhere in between.
Wow.
And they are a native species of bat that is actually migratory. I remember one time I was on a ferry going between Cape May, New Jersey, and Lewes, Delaware.
Yeah.
And flying right alongside the boat in the middle of the day were a couple of red bats heading south.
Well, I'll be darned.
Yeah. And that's part of the magnificent variety we have in wildlife in New York.
Okay, well, super.
Or in Vermont, for that matter. Yes,
you've cleared up my question. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Jim. Well, you
may not be birds, but they fly, so we try to cover them.
All right, let's go to Mike in Saratoga. Mike, you're on.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to have Rich on with Birds. I look forward to it. I just had a quick question. I have a bird feeder in the backyard and live in downtown Saratoga Springs. And I put up little defenders kind of to keep pigeons out. But now I'm just watching these two couples of blue jays just eat away and, like, put me in the poorhouse here. They keep knocking the seed on the ground and eating it. I'm wondering, is there anything to block the blue jays or at least get them to take it easy?
Well, for one thing, what I do is I like to use cracked corn. That I set aside in a different location. And cracked corn is a lot cheaper than some of the bird seed that you buy in the bags. And the blue jays, they love it. They'll go to that first. And so it gets me off the cheap on that.
I agree. Okay. That's what I do with mine as well.
Cracked corn.
Or you could get some of these bird feeders, shop around. Some of them are designed so that only the smaller birds can get into them. They may have a little wire mesh around them, or some of them actually have a treadle that is activated by the weight of the visitor. If it's a larger a bird, such as a blue jay or a grackle or a squirrel, the door closes by the treadle, and it stays open for the sparrows and chickadees and nuthatches. So
there you go. Well, Mike.
All right. Well, thanks for the suggestion.
We appreciate
sure
the
enough.
Call. Just a question. I just thought of this. How much money a month do you spend on bird food?
I don't. Actually, it lasts me quite a while because what I do is I have black oil sunflower seed, and I don't have any yet, but I will get some thistle seed, the Niger seed, and the cracked corn, and suet. I like to put suet out because that adds a great variety to the different birds. And, you know, it seems to be a pretty balanced diet for them.
And you only do that in the cold weather months?
Oh, no. I feed through the summer as well.
You do.
I don't have to worry about things like bears and the like.
I bet you do, though, Kelly.
Oh, yes. We occasionally get bears. And I gave up on bird feeders. I just use my rock walls in the ground.
Yeah, that works. A lot of birds will readily come to the ground and use the ground as a feeder.
Kelly, have you ever rehabilitated a bear?
Not recently. I have had cubs in the past. Currently in New York State, there's really only one rehabilitator that has what the state considers safe, secure, and adequate housing for bears. So I could accept one temporarily, but I wouldn't keep it for very long. Wow. I would end up transferring it to the other rehabilitator.
Rehabilitators are licensed by both the federal government and New York State.
Correct.
I mean, there's strict controls about who can harbor for good reason wildlife.
Correct.
Are you on call 24/7 with this gig?
Yeah. I live fairly rural, so we're surrounded by state land. I'm not as accessible as a lot of the other rehabilitators in the more urban areas, but I get a fair number of calls.
We are joined today by Kelly Martin, who is an educator and wildlife rehabilitator, and our own Rich Guthrie, our bird expert, and it's the Bird Show, don't you know? And we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolting Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Get more info, hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Spate Consulting and Coaching, Shelburne Falls. More than 20 years of working with leaders and teams committed to purposeful change. See it whole and move it forward. dlspecht.com. Grapes and Grains, Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York. Offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans. Hand-picked selection of wines, single malts, and small batch bourbons. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Hudson Wine Merchants in Hudson, New York, offering selections for holiday meals, gifts, and everyday wines. Curbside service and delivery available. Raise your glass. HudsonWines.com. And Penny Farthing Investment Management, Amherst, a socially conscious, fee-only investment advisor of personal, retirement, and endowment portfolios, including the Bright Penny Community Strategies, brightpenny.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. Our number is 800-348-2551. It is a pre-Thanksgiving edition, and we welcome back Rich Guthrie, who has taken time out of his busy cooking day to join us today. Also, Kelly Martin, who is an educator and wildlife rehabilitator. And, Rich, you have some events that you want to plug here.
I do. A couple of things coming up, and also some club activities that'll be coming up in the near future.
Okay.
Now's a great time for getting out to the learn about the outdoors, take the kids out, and enjoy what you can. Down in Dutchess County, New York, the Waterman Bird Club on the 30th of November will be going to Mills Mansion in Statsburg, New York.
Okay.
For a morning walk and bird walk. Meet at 9 a.m., and you can find out about them at watermanbirdclub.org. Same group on the 7th of December will be going to Thompson's Pond near Pine Plains, New York.
Okay.
And then on the 26th, the Mearns Bird Club out of Orange County, New York, will be visiting Ulster County, going to the Schwangunk Grasslands at 4:30 in the afternoon, just as it's beginning to get dark, to look for the owls and the northern harriers and other grassland bird species. And that's the Mearns Bird Club, M-E-A-R-N-S, birdclub.org. Up in Montpelier, Vermont, on Monday mornings at 9:30 a.m., the North Branch Nature Center.org has kids programs from 9:30 to 11:30, up near Montpelier, Vermont.
Yeah,
opportunity
beautiful.
To have some guided walks with the kids. And there they like to have a donation if you're going to be attending.
I see.
And as for evening programs, I'll be doing the Hudson
Cuba tour. Here we go.
Cuba, December 5th at the Colony Library in Colony, New York, with the Hudson Mohawk Bird Club. I'll be doing my program about Cuba, the birds, the people, the cars, and the cigars.
All right.
That's at 7 p.m. at the and there's no fee charged to attend there. And then on the 8th, over in Sand Lake Town Hall, New York, with the Rensselaer Plateau Conservancy, I'll be doing a program about winter birds in the Rensselaer Plateau, Rensselaer County, New York,
delightful.
In effect in Northeast New York. And that's at 7 o'clock on December 8th, the Sand Lake Town Hall.
Did you get an agent yet?
No, I should.
You really need to up your fees. You're doing these for free.
Yeah.
And I think there's money to be made here, Guthrie.
Well, I'll be looking for that. No, free works for me.
Yeah, well, you're and that's why you're here, actually, oddly enough. All right, before we get back to the phones at 800-348-2551, let's take a couple of emails that came in. This is from Pete in Toland, Mass. Since you brought up turkeys, I have to ask, what do wild turkeys find to eat here in the Berkshires in the wintertime? And is there something we can do to help with their survival here? We have flocks slash gangs of them. First of all, what is a group of turkeys called?
A flock.
Flock. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Works for me.
All right. So that's from Pete. So what do they eat in the Berkshires?
Lots of, well, the mast is what's called the fallen acorns and beech nuts and seed pods that come off the trees during the fall is their main diet in the woods. Lots of times you'll see turkeys working the edges of a cornfield. Voila. Lots of leftovers there. So...
Yeah, and they come around my house to where I put the corn out sometimes.
You help them along.
That's inadvertently.
Yeah, well, that's good. Turkeys are wild birds.
They don't come every day.
But... Yeah. Right. I think they're magnificent birds to have around. They're just so much, they're so entertaining to watch as well as, you know, such huge birds right in our own backyards.
This one is from Veronica, who says, I live in a city neighborhood and use black oil sunflower seed and suet in my feeders. Most years, I have the usual variety of winter birds in my feeders, but this year, the house sparrows have taken over my feeders, sometimes as many as 40 of them at a time. Except for a cardinal and two chickadees, I haven't seen the other regulars, such as woodpeckers, nuthatches, and juncos. Is it too early in the season for them? Is there a way to discourage the sparrows? And that's from Veronica.
Well, unfortunately, I can't, other than... a feeder that they can't get into. The same thing is happening to me. I've rarely ever had house sparrows. These are the introduced species that came over.
You don't like them very much.
Well, it's not that I don't like them. Birds will congregate where there's activity, other birds' activity, and they serve as a good attraction for lots of wild birds. And I encourage folks, I might take the opportunity to look among those house sparrows because other birds might mix in with them. The other sparrow species, such as the white-throated sparrow, or the white-crowned sparrow, or even this, some of the rare birds might be attracted to a flock of house sparrows. They're all opportunists and are looking for what looks like an easy meal. And the house sparrows are out there as carrying the sandwich board advertising free, easy lunch.
Okay, this one's from Colleen. On a similar tact here, I've never seen the flowering crab apples in Washington Park without clusters of red fruit at this time of year. The acorns I've seen on the ground are mostly cap with very little nut. Is this a low-mast year? And if so, what can we do to help overwintering birds now and returning migrants later? And that's from Colleen in Albany.
Well, that's a good question. The best advice I can offer is maybe not for this year, but in subsequent years, it's a plant beneficial food-producing vegetation around the grounds.
I don't know if they'll take too kindly to that in Washington Park.
Washington Park has a nice variety of bird-friendly food available. Okay. The crab apples themselves are, and what's interesting about crab apples is that it's usually a late winter, early spring delectable for the birds. Mm-hmm. They're left over. The birds pass over them. Through the fall, through the winter, and then as spring arrives, the birds are attracted to them. And I think that's all about the freeze-thaw cycle of the fruit on the tree.
Sweetens there up. May be more sugar available in them later in the season as well.
Right, yeah. The breakdown of the fruit itself. Yeah.
Okay, we'll get back to the phones in a moment. Last email, and this is from Charles. I don't see purple martins anymore. Growing up in eastern Connecticut, my dad always had martin houses. We would watch them all summer. I recently tried to purchase a martin house from a store and was told that martins are not in New England anymore. Is this true? That's from Charles.
That's true. Purple martins are a type of swallow, insect-eating birds that are not here now. They're down in South America someplace for the winter. But the purple martin used to be here in smallmouth. We're at the fringe of their range, the northern edge of their range. They're still found along the coast. There's still some colonies in the coastal areas of New York, New England, especially as you go further south. Interestingly enough, maybe 20, 40 years ago, purple martins were found here in the Capital District of New York and elsewhere, the Connecticut Valley. But the numbers have dwindled, the colonies have disappeared, and the birds are now hard to find. So the garden store proprietor did you good service by discouraging you from buying a purple martin house. Breaks my heart to see purple martin houses out there because I know they're going to remain vacant for a while. We do have a colony down in New Paltz, New York, thanks to the New York Thruway Authority, who maintains it periodically. The martin colony is doing well. And also there are martins found on the lakes to the north of us, Lake Champlain and Saratoga Lake. But aside from that, they're very few and far between.
Well, back to the phones we will go at 800-348-2551. Al in Skodak, you're on, Al.
Well, good afternoon, and thanks for taking the call. Great show.
Thanks.
My question is not about any of the cute little birds, but I was going into my shed a couple of days ago, and I swung open the door, and I looked off to the side of my shed, probably 6 feet away from me, and there was a hawk, which to me looked like the size of a fire hydrant, having lunch. And my question is, do hawks or birds of prey like that have any aggressive tendency if you have to stumble upon one while he's on the ground eating?
Great question.
Kelly?
Very rarely. During breeding season, there are a few species that are known to actively defend nests, great horned owls, goshawks. You're not that likely to encounter them, but for the most part, their reaction is going to be to fly away if possible, and that would be the first response. Some of them may do what we call mantling their prey, where they spread their wings over it to protect it, to prevent somebody else from taking it away from them.
Yeah.
However, they usually are more afraid of us. We're bigger predators to them, so they tend to want to flight or fright. The flight kicks in first.
All right, Al, thank you very much for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie and Kelly Martin here, and we talk birds on this pre-Thanksgiving edition of Vox Pop. Let's go to Anne Marie in Rhinebeck. Anne Marie, you're on.
Hello?
Anne Marie? Oh.
Anne Marie.
Have you waited that long, Anne Marie, and you're not with us?
Basting the turkey.
I'm sure. I'm sure. Sorry, Anne Marie. If you call in again, we'll try to get you in there. Obviously, something came up. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley, Mass. Joanna, you're on.
Yes, hi, thank you. Well, I have a flying thing question rather than a bird question, which is I've always enjoyed seeing the occasional bat in the dusk sky, and we bought a bat house a couple of years ago, but then shortly thereafter a family moved next door that now has six children under the age of 10. And I just wanted a sense about, and they're out all hours of the day and night, is there any danger in terms of rabies and bats and putting up a bat house in our backyard? We do share a very long property boundary together, and the kids will be out there and about.
Well, my feeling about most bat houses is that most of the time bats don't live in them. I'm not sure if it's the structure itself, where it's located. There are some occasions where they take up residents in them, but not typically. And as far as the rabies concern, obviously any wild animal that's on the ground and not flying or running away or lets a person walk up to it is a concern, and to teach kids that lesson. However, and bat rabies is always prevalent in the population, but at a really, really, really low rate. So your likelihood of an encountering a rabid bat is very low. But obviously, it is something to be concerned about and to tell kids to always get an adult if they see one on the ground.
Fair enough.
Do you suggest people provide the bat houses? I mean, we bought this from a nature center, so I'm assuming that it was...
I think it's a nice notion, and it also depends on what species of bats are around. Some of them are communal dwellers and like to take up residence in people's attics where we often don't want them. Some of them are solitary tree dwellers, so it will depend on what is around you. And again, I just don't find they take up residence in them that often.
Well, they have it, though.
Okay, thank you very much for handling the question.
Okay, John.
Well, and again, depending on what it was sold for, what kind of bat, it might just be worth a little internet search in terms of, you know, how high up, facing what direction, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Our number here is 800-348-2551. George in Northampton. George, you're on.
Hi, folks. Hey, don't panic. I'm not going to ask a political question, although it might sound like it at first. Huh. I was reading the interview in the New York Times with Donald Trump, and he said that he was opposed to wind power because of all the birds that it killed. And I was just wondering if you could set the record straight on the threat, damage, whatever is known from wind power and how many birds actually are injured or killed because of the increasing number of power stations that are wind-based. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
That's my question.
You got it. You going to hang on the line or you want to go?
Yeah, no, I will hang on.
Okay.
Okay, well, that's a question we really don't know the total answer to, unfortunately. But here's the background that as I see it. Wind generators are put on ridges that have winds. That's how they work. Hawks and eagles fly along ridges that have winds. That's how they work. So there's the element of inevitable conflict there. Those wind blades go around. They spin. They look like they're going at a nice, gentle, easygoing, nice pace. They are actually whipping around at a tremendous speed. The outer edge of those blades is going faster than you could drive a car down the highway.
Huh.
They're an incredible speed. And birds, whether it be the crow, well, the crows, the songbirds along the highway, crows are pretty smart. They learn to avoid. But most birds can't judge the oncoming speed of a vehicle, so they don't know. They would like to get out of the way, but they just don't have it in their head adjust to that speed. And the same thing is true with these blades on these wind turbines. So unfortunately, it is known that the wind blades take a tremendous toll on Raptors. Unfortunately, a lot of the licensees, the people who run these wind stations, have a provision in there where they are the only ones who can monitor the effect. They do not let independent biologists in on their property to examine the potential fatalities. And so
that seems like a problem.
It's a self-serving interest on their part to not reveal.
Exactly. That's what I mean by problem.
Yes, you're right about that. So they're loath to release the data that they have, and we don't know. But when you look at the ingredients and add the columns up, the conflict is real, and I do, from what I have seen, there is a strong correlation between wind power and migrating raptor fatalities.
I think there's a concern too, and I don't have statistics on it, but in the eastern United States, also for migrating bats, that there may be a problem for them as well.
Yeah, they don't. That's very true, and in fact, it's a bigger problem than one would have imagined. It's a little bat flying through. It's like it should be able to slip through there without a problem. But they found out that there is indeed a higher than expected, and maybe critically higher than expected mortality rate among bats.
Let's go to Susan in Boston Spa. Susan, you're on.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about raptors. Last month, on the outskirts of Lake George, I was at a friend's house. We were in her backyard. She has a large pond in her yard, and there are Canada geese on the pond. This very, very large brownish bird flew down and attempted to fly away with a Canada goose.
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was, this was a golden eagle. So do we have golden eagles in this area?
Well, yes, but not likely what you saw. What you saw is more than likely a bald eagle.
A juvenile, probably. Okay.
Right. A young bald eagle will be all brown like that and look very much like a golden eagle. Bald eagles really love Canada geese.
Really?
If they could snag a Canada goose, as big as a Canada goose is, I've seen bald eagles go after them quite successfully. It's usually...
It was incredible. I couldn't believe it was trying to pick up a goose.
Yeah, well, what they do is they'll sail through a flock, and most of the geese will get right out of the way. And they're looking for the one that's a little bit behind the times, you know, a little slower.
The weakest link.
The weakest, right. The one that can't dodge. Then they'll work on that. And my golly, it's a very... Now, when you mention golden eagles, let me do say that if you want to see golden eagles, Franklin Mountain near Oneonta, New York, is the place to go. They have seen over 200 golden eagles so far this year, and we're still in the high range of their migration right now. Franklin Mountain near Oneonta by the Delaware Otsego Audubon Society website will bring you to the directions to get there. Dress warm. Go on a day when there's a good stiff north wind. You'll be cold if you're not careful, but you'll see golden eagles.
Rich Guthrie is our guest. We're also joined today by Kelly Martin. The number is 800-348-2551, and we hit the home stretch in a moment.
Support for WAMC comes from Bodywork Professionals Licensed Massage Therapists, Nick Pavaldi, Advanced Structural Integration Practitioner, Proprietor. Offices in Latham and Saratoga Springs open 7 days, your massage and bodywork experts, bodyworkprofessionals.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, now selling seasoned firewood, tumble screened, and free of debris, cut, split, and delivered. Super sacks of 1/3 of a cordwood now available, whitneysfarm.com. Albany Pine Bush Discovery Center, a nature center with interactive exhibits in a 3,200-acre preserve with 20 miles of trails, open daily with programs for adults and children, albanypinebush.org. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses, nbtbank.com. Alexander House Luxury Residence Suites, Saratoga Springs, a historic mansion featuring 14 studio and 1 or 2 bedroom suites for weekly, monthly, and annual leasing. AlexanderHouseSuites.com. And Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. Careers in Transition, LLC.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here on this day before Thanksgiving. Rich Guthrie is joining us and Kelly Martin as well. And as I was going to break, Rich held up a sign that just said cats. As I was speaking, going to break, I wasn't about to say the word cats for no reason. What did you want to say about cats? As if I didn't know.
Well, we can talk. We talk about conflicts with birds, and cats is one of those. And this is one area that I know Kelly is very passionate about, as well as I am, because of the really unappreciated damage that cats have on wildlife, and especially birds.
Well, and not just birds, reptiles, small mammals, all kinds of things. I've even had full-grown adult squirrels and cottontail rabbits brought to me that somebody's cat had gotten. But certainly on songbirds that are easy pickings off bird feeders in the spring when young or summer when young birds are fledging out of the nest and they're not flighted right away, they're very vulnerable to cat predation. And cats cause an awful lot of damage. And when I see the casualties, it's very, very sad because it should be a preventable thing.
All right.
And the thing is, a lot of people will bring a bird to a rehabilitator and say, here, fix this. And the bird is beyond fixing. Yeah. The cat drags it in. Once it's those very sharp teeth puncture the bird's skin, the infection rate is so incredibly high, the mortality rate. It's almost like irreversible damage.
Yes, even if the initial damage doesn't get them, often the bacterial infection does.
All right. This came in via email, Kelly, from your neighbor, Jackie. Who says, hello to my neighbor, Kelly. I have many varieties of birds that visit our yard, but I rarely, if ever, see cardinals. What can I do to attract them? That's from your neighbor.
Well, I'll let Rich answer that one.
Well, cardinals.
Hi, Jackie.
cardinals are a feeder-loving bird. If you have sunflower seed, cardinals will love you. But they're more of a valley bird than a mountain bird.
Yeah.
You guys are up on the hilltops.
We are at a higher elevation. I rarely see cardinals in my yard.
Yeah, like they say.
Occasionally.
You ain't no flatlander.
No.
And cardinals are.
Do they say that? You ain't no flatlander?
They do.
They do. Well, we have cardinals in our backyard.
You be a flatlander?
I be a flatlander.
There
Thank you,
go,
you Rich.
Then.
Nancy in Eddyville. Nancy, the noise is deafening. Are you in a blizzard?
A jet plane.
Hi.
Oh, can you take it off speaker?
Turn it off. Okay.
Yeah, yes. I think it's you're on speakerphone, aren't you? Nancy, hello.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, the speakerphone's very very noisy. So what we'll do is we'll have you ask your question and then we'll turn you down.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I actually have two. If I can ask them both, this is Nancy, formerly of Saugerties. Hi, Rich. Miss you.
Oh, hi.
Hi. I get a lot of birds in my yard, and I've been trying to attract bluebirds. I know they're in the neighborhood. I've got bluebird houses. How do I get the bluebirds in the yard?
It's all about food. If you have food, the bluebirds will arrive. And they like the berries, wild grapes, or honeysuckle, native honeysuckle plants will do well. Some of the rose flowers will produce hips that the bluebirds will like.
Okay.
I encourage you to try food and also keep those bluebird nest boxes going. Even in the winter, they might come by and find a safe harbor.
All right, Nancy, what is your second question?
Okay, speaking of cats, will great horned owls attack house cats?
I have heard that they will. I think as aggressive and powerful as a great horned owl is, taking a cat is difficult. Maybe a kitten or an old cat, but I think your basic healthy cat would be difficult for a great horned owl, again, even as powerful as they are.
Okay, well, we'll have to leave Nancy there. A lot of noise on the background there, and it's hard on the ears. Let's go to Larry in Ancrumdale. Larry, you're on.
Yes, thank you. Rich, in your last show, you happened to mention that you like crows.
I do.
I must contact Rich.
I like crows,
And you're aware that in the winter, some cities have a lot of crows take up rookery residence in their communities. I saw it in Albany. I saw it in Auburn. And what the towns tend to do is harass the crows to go to the next town, which I don't think is a very nice thing to do. And I have an idea I wanted to run by you and see what you think, and that is that we collect some financing to build a rookery on, say, the edge of a cornfield, a structure that would invite the crows to spend their wintertime evening in these establishments. I want to know what you think of that idea.
Well, that's what we're doing. That's what they are doing. First of all, wintertime crows are very gregarious. They are attracted to large assemblies, and unfortunately, they seem to like urban settings, the edges of cities and downtown settings, and so the agencies go out to discourage the crows, to scatter them. And what the crows do is they're not as dumb as they look. They get out there and they find a edge of a cornfield. They find a cemetery or some other quiet place where people will leave them alone and they will gather there instead. So the effort is directed at that for that goal.
Okay. Well, Larry, thanks a lot for the call. Over to Emily in Wappingers Falls. Emily, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Sure. I had actually heard a story on one of the programs from WAMC about different bird houses, and that the smaller the bird feeder, I should say, the smaller the hole of the bird feeder, there was this species of birds that were getting eye disease, and that was contributing to the decline in the bird species. And there was a study done, I think it was at Virginia Tech. So I was curious about that and what you knew about that.
We've talked about this before, the conjunctivitis, right?
That's correct. Kelly?
Yes, and it is primarily a finch disease, and which will congregate at bird feeders. And if you see a bird that's infected, it usually is an indication that it's time to clean your bird feeder, disinfect it, and prevent it from spreading.
And the usual victim of this conjunctivitis disease is very highly contagious, but seems to affect primarily the house finch, which is not native to this area.
I've had goldfinches with it, but primarily finches.
Yes, the house finches are the ones that are impacted the greatest by this. There is going to be the occasional wild bird that will have conjunctivitis. It's in the environment, but the resistance strain among wilder birds is strong enough to keep it down to a low number. But the house finch seem to be vulnerable. They seem to have an immunity deficiency, and it's probably because all of our house finches came from a core stock that was released sometime in the 1940s down on Long Island. So they all came from this one small genetic pool. And in there, through crossbreeding amongst themselves, as the population expanded, is this weak genetic link, giving them immunity deficiency, vulnerable to conjunctivitis. There seems to be a resurgence of house finches, and so there's probably the weak strain has probably been cleaned out of the population, and so now we have a stronger, more resistant strain.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that this surge that swept through primarily the house finch and occasionally crossed over into the goldfinches or purple finches is pretty well diminished and a threat more of the past, but something to be vigilant about.
Is that a bacterial or a viral?
It is bacterial.
And so antibiotics?
Yes, we can treat it if we get them soon enough. What often happens is because they can't see, they can't eat, and therefore usually when we get them, not only are the eyes closed shut with this infection, but they're very thin and emaciated.
And they become easy prey for...
And they become easy prey.
Yes.
Let's go over to Mark in Del Mar. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Hi, Dick. Mark, you might recognize my voice.
It's Rich and
Kelly. I have a woodpecker working on cedar siding on one spot of my house. It likes to make a horizontal series of holes. I don't think I have an insect infestation. When I put up a bird feeder a couple of months ago, it seemed to get worse or it seemed to start up again. Also, there's cellulose insulation, which they seem to spread around once they get through the siding. The Cornell website, you know, talked about it drumming. You know, they do it kind of for entertainment, possibly, and didn't have much good suggestions other than putting up fine wires to kind of cover over the spot. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Nope.
No, not at all.
Well, Cornell pretty well hit it on the nail there. Basically, have you figured out what kind of woodpecker this is?
He said horizontal holes. I wonder if it's a sapsucker.
Well,
no.
Go ahead, Mark.
I think it's a hairy.
Yeah. Okay. The sapsucker would be going after the sap in the tree, and they drill those horizontal holes in a sappy tree, like an apple or a beech, a birch tree. The siding on your house, something is drawing the woodpecker to it, and if it's not the insects, then it's the resonance. That's all they're interested in, one or the other. And the resonance part is only during the breeding season. They're declaring their territory with this drumming sound that they make. So back to Cornell, you went right to the source there, and I would suggest, follow their instruction. If that doesn't work, I don't get the connection between more a woodpecker feeder and intensity of drilling on their part on the side of your house.
It was just a regular bird feeder, but the woodpecker was climbing around on the bird feeder quite a bit for whatever reason, and then this problem seemed to get much worse all of a sudden.
Yeah, I think that's coincidental.
So, okay, maybe. Yeah. Okay.
So.
All right. Well. Maybe I'll call an exterminator.
No.
I can't.
Well,
I don't see any. I inspect very carefully the holes, and I don't see any evidence of any insect damage at all.
Is it widespread or fairly localized, like a very small area?
It's just one row. It's at a very high elevation, right under the eaves, and he seems to be interested in making a horizontal band, right? You know, if once I seal up one hole, he moves over and makes another one right next to it.
Yeah, I suspect there's somebody in there.
Okay.
That's my thinking, Mark.
Maybe.
Well, Mark, thanks a
lot
for the call.
Not good news, I know.
No, it's terrible news, as a matter of fact. Let's go to Frank and Lee Mass. Frank, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I have a question about a sound I hear, a bird call. I like
Excellent.
To watch raptors, so when I see them flying, I'll hear the hawk do their scree sound.
Yes.
And sometimes I'll hear that sound. I look up. I don't see anything, and it seems to come from a stationary point, probably in some trees, but it's hard for me to see who's doing it. One time I think I saw that a blue jay was doing it.
Yep.
And it's a sound like a...
Ouch, that hurts.
Yeah, well, actually,
you know, that's
good for you.
That kind of... Yeah, so is that what's happening?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep, blue jays, remarkable critters that they are. They do a series of very good imitations, even better than you, of hawk sounds, better than I can do. And they're very convincing. I use my little baby room monitors to listen to what's going on outside. And every now and then I'll hear what sounds like a red-shouldered hawk. And I'll go outside because in my yard that would be unusual. And I go outside and there's nothing but a blue jay out there.
So why do they do that?
That's a good question. We really don't know.
They can mimic sounds.
Yeah, and why they do it is, I don't know.
Do you have a guess? There must be an evolutionary reason for this.
Yeah, and it's also learned. I mean, they
just do it for a laugh?
To see who responds. It may be... They certainly don't want to draw in
Maybe
a hawk to their
territory. Maybe they're scaring the smaller birds away from the bird seed so they can go in and hoard it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Devious.
Just a deception call. But I'm open to suggestions as to why the blue jay benefits from imitating the sound of a hawk. The red-tailed hawk, which is what the call that we just
That's
heard.
That's what I hear.
Yeah. Or the red-shouldered hawk or the broad-winged hawk. They do it. They have, and I think it's individual ones have their own specialty. They own the little tricks that they use.
Rich Guthrie and Kelly Martin are here, and let's go to Will in Woodstock. Will, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
My questions, I have a couple of questions, concern whippoorwills.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I grew up in around Woodstock, New York. We had a small farm, and we would eat outside when the weather was good. And at twilight, more often than not, we would hear whippoorwills.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually driving home one night with my mom. We actually saw one in a headlight, and they're be kind. They're not really a great looking bird. So my second set of questions is: somebody told me that they are nocturnal. Mm-hmm. And they are flightless.
No.
So I'm going to hang up and listen to you on the radio.
Okay, they certainly can fly. The whippoorwill has gone through a drastic decrease in numbers over the last few decades in our area. The reasons are obscure, but it's all about food.
Yeah.
And I think our nocturnal flying insects, which is their main fare, have disappeared. Either through light pollution, you know, moths are their main food.
Yeah.
Moths are drawn to lights. More lights, more moths are drawn to their own peril, diminishing the numbers and depleting the food supply. And the whippoorwills disappear.
All right, Rich Guthrie, how can people get in touch with you?
Easily. RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com or through the Times Union blog.
And the Times Union blog, you just search for birds?
TimesUnion.com. Okay. And then look for the blog page, and you'll see birding.
And Guthrie is spelled how?
G Guthrie.
So Richard P. Guthrie at gmail.com. Well, Rich, thanks for being here. Kelly Martin, I hope you come back.
I'd love to.
Maybe we'll get you on and you can get a word in edgewise. We know. That's what happens with Guthrie. You know, he takes over the show.
That's all right. I've known him a long time.
You're very tolerant. Good for you. Support comes from Union College Concert Series, presenting the Emerson String Quartet, performing works by Ravel, Shostakovich, and Debussy in the ensemble's 40th anniversary season, Sunday, December 4th, 3 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. Waterwheelvillage.com. Chester Common Table, new restaurant on Main Street, Chester, Massachusetts. Locally sourced comfort food, beers and spirits, outdoor seating, live music weekends, comfortable setting. ChesterCommonTable.com. And the Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org. Thanks again to Rich Guthrie and Kelly Martin for being here. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks for all the great calls. Thanks to Zachary T. Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered today by Carol Lapani. Nice job, Carol. And our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Have a great Thanksgiving. I'll tell you what, we are very thankful for you being here and supporting us and listening to this radio station. No show tomorrow or Friday. Vox Pop will be back on Monday. Alan will be here for Medical Monday. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Stand by for news.